Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, May 26th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the Internet through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice at whyagain.org. If you go to that webpage and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book provides a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. And if you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often, as it frequently leads to comments, questions, answers, and testimonials, as well as improving people's lives, one situation at a time, one reality management worksheet at a time, one breath session at a time, one EFT tapping session at a time. And if you have any of those comments, questions, or testimonials to share with us, you can call us at 563-999-3581. When you call that number and press 1, it'll put the icon of a hand by your phone number. I'll turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code. Alternatively, you can give us a call or send us an email, tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeanie at whyagain.org, whyagain.org. And if we get an email from you with a comment or a question or an answer or a testimonial, we will address that on the Internet show. And then, as time allows, we'll send you an email letting you know the day and time that we address your comment or question or testimonial so you can listen to it in the archives. Today is a Thursday, as I mentioned in the opening, and that means we have another support group tonight. On each Tuesday and Thursday night, barring technical difficulties, snowstorms, or major holidays, on those very days, we have MindShifter support groups that we offer through Zoom. So all you have to do is have internet access and be willing to tune in on Tuesday or Thursday night at 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. And if you do that, you'll be able to join us. And we encourage people to do that because it is a wonderful community and a lot of good work gets done in there. A lot of good ideas are exchanged. A lot of people do individual processing. And a lot of people get exposed to material that they don't get exposed to anywhere else in their life. So if you feel called to join us, all the information you would need to do that is at mindshiftersacademy.org. And if you don't feel that you're called to join us, but and or it just doesn't work out in your schedule, but you know somebody else that might benefit from it, we encourage you to share that information with them. And the more the merrier in that support group process. Since the beginning of January, we've been working through the Course in Miracles. No, that was last year. The Way of Mastery. And we are going through fairly slowly and methodically. And we're referencing as we go with commentary how self-referential the book is, how things in the first lesson refer to things that are found in most of the other lessons and vice versa. And here in the last lesson of the first book, this thing we call The Way of Mastery was originally presented as three separate books. The Way of the Heart, The Way of Transformation, and The Way of Knowing. And what we're reading here so far is the first book, The Way of the Heart. And in the last lesson, or the last chapter in The Way of the Heart, the first two pages, maybe the first three pages, are all about making statements to the effect that everything that follows, if you want to really get value out of the next two books or the other lessons that are following, it's essential that you go back and dig deeper for the gems and the deeper meanings and the changes in your experience of life that can come if you choose to do the practices that were recommended. And it highlights the fact that the most powerful of them is the idea of sitting in a chair for 5 minutes a day, simply tuning into the fact that your thoughts, your mind energy is a creative force. And after you've tuned into that for a while, you might choose to experience what it would be like to create completely consciously as a Christ would create, as someone that is a part of the flow of the creative, one creative mind, can create consciously, directly, effortlessly, day in and day out, moment to moment. And where we left off yesterday was another reference back to the idea of being a gardener and how the master gardener understands they are not the ones that make things grow. They are simply preparing the soil. They're arranging the conditions. They are cultivating the things they have control over. But there is another force far greater than they have in their conscious logical mind. And the same force that gave rise to them and keeps their heart beating and their food digesting is the very same force that brings growth to the things that are planted, whether we're talking about planting actual physical seeds of grains and fruits and vegetables in the soil, or we're talking about planting thoughts into our consciousness and holding mind energy on them, giving them value, pouring that creative energy into the individual thoughts. Either way, the wise gardener, the master gardener, the wise person, individual, the spiritually minded person understands they're not the one that's creating that mind energy. They're just pointing it in one direction or another. They don't know the source of it. They don't know how it is that it creates. They just know that it's there. And they understand that they have dominion not over the energy, but over where the energy is pointed. The energy is always on. It's always creating. It's always going to be flowing. And so the only thing the master gardener or the wise spiritual seeker understands is that they have the control over where to point it, but not its essence and not the fact that it is going to continue to create in a constant flow wherever it's pointed. So since no one has a hands up, I'll come back to this lesson 12, page 145 in the blue book. And the text reads, some of you are still seeking to understand your mind, the mind, by seeing it as something that is locked inside the shape of your skull and is somehow cohabitating with what you call the gray matter of the brain. Rest assured, your mind, your conscious awareness is unlimited forever. The body that sits in the chair in your five-minute exercise is a drop of foam being expressed at the slightest tip of one wave in an infinite ocean. The ocean is itself within the unlimited expanse of your mind. So the thing you call a body, this tiny bit of energy that has been slowed, so slowed down that it can be perceived by our physical senses, it exists within the consciousness of your mind. Because as the text says here, you are consciousness. As such, you are pure spirit. Your essence is pure energy, pure consciousness. The text goes on and says, the only question then is this. Are you willing to allow that drop of foam to be transformed into that which fully and always expresses only the love of the Creator? That foam that, again, they're referring here to, it's an illusion to your body. Are you willing to let your body be transformed into that which fully and always expresses only the love of the Creator, even though that expression is still temporary because the body has arisen in the field of time and it disappears in the field of time? Are you willing to say, well, what the heck, and allow that love, that creative energy, to be as fully embodied as is possible for it to be for the split second that the body is in the world? So here again is a reference to time. What we think of as this long, arduous process to go from conception to a teenager who graduates high school or starts working outside the home is not even the blink of an eye. The entire expanse of what we call time from a child being born to a child dying at 100 or 120 years old is less than the blink of an eye. I remember in the story of Indra, as Joseph Campbell tells the story, he says, he's trying to, in the story, one of the higher teachers is trying to explain to the king of the gods, Indra, that he's not the first king of the gods to ever be. And the essence of the story is that Vishnu floats in the cosmic ocean, and from Vishnu's navel, as Vishnu floats in the cosmic ocean, a lotus flower blossoms. And when the lotus flower blossoms, it opens, and there's a Brahman sitting in the lotus flower. And each time the Brahman opens its eyes, a world comes into view, and an entire universe comes into view. And that universe is governed by an Indra, a king of the gods. And then every time the Brahman closes its eyes, the world disappears. And then the Brahman opens its eyes again, and another world is created, ruled by an Indra. And he closes his eyes, and that world disappears. And he opens his eyes, and the world, a new world appears, a new universe appears, ruled by an Indra. And as the story goes, the life of the Brahman is 10,000 years. And when the Brahman dies, the lotus flower retreats into the navel of Vishnu, who's floating in the cosmic ocean, and then another lotus flower blossoms. Sitting on that lotus flower is another Brahman, that every time the Brahman opens his eyes, another world comes into view, comes into existence. And that world is governed by an Indra, the king of the gods of that world or universe. And every time that Brahman closes its eyes, that world or universe fades from existence. And then he opens his eyes, and a new universe, governed by a new Indra, comes into existence. And that Brahman's life is 10,000 years. So as the story goes, the teacher is telling the Indra in this story that while there might be wise men in the kingdom of the gods that Indra is the king of, who would count the stars in the sky, or maybe even the grains of sand on all the beaches in the universe that this Indra rules, that there are none that would count the number of Brahmins that there have been, let alone the number of universes that have come and gone in and out of existence with the blink of the Brahmin's eyes. So the Way of Mastery here just made a reference to that kind of existence outside of time. The Way of Mastery is saying, the only question then is this: are you willing to allow your body, what you consider your physical body, to be transformed into that which fully and always expresses only the love of creation, even though that expression from that tip of foam, that body that you have, is temporary? Because the body is temporary, and we know it's temporary because it's arisen within the field of time and it disappears within the field of time. And are you willing to say, oh, what the heck, I might as well get on with it, and allow that energy of creation, that capital L love, to be as fully embodied as is possible for the split second that the body exists in the world? This is a reference to the fact that your lifespan, the lifespans of every human you've ever heard about or read about, is but a split second. This is a reference to the fact that your consciousness is beyond words expansive, and that your physical body and the physical bodies of everyone that you have ever known and the universe, the stars, the galaxies, all of that arises within your consciousness. So what's, you know, what's being asked here is, are you willing to let a different perspective take root, be seeded, and be cultivated within you, a perspective which says everything that you valued, all of the material things in your life, all of the relationships with the physical bodies that you have, that you ever have had, that you're having now, that you hope to have in the future, that they're all occurring within what would be essentially less than the blink of an eye. And that your true essence and the creative flow of life and the mind of the creator of which you are a part extends endlessly. The text goes on and reads, expressing mastery is the effect of the way of transformation in this world, in this time, in this little tiny moment. Rest assured, to the degree that you turn your attention to expressing mastery, to the degree that you use time wisely to be the embodied Christ, to the degree that you do that, when the body drops away and it veils from you no longer the magnificence of the light that you are, if you've done that, that light will not be blinding to you. If you've let yourself be transformed into that which extends only love, teaches only love, values only loving thoughts to the highest degree possible, then you will not contract in fear when the body fades away and you are confronted with a blinding light. If all of that happens, you will merely let this world go very gently, as easily as a child has put away a toy that it has outgrown. Imagine that. Imagine going through the transition that this book has said we mistakenly call death, and having our peace remain completely intact. The text goes on and says, all that you see, the body, your relationships, your devices, and your stars, your winds and your waters, all of this will eventually be put aside by you. Not out of denial, simply out of recognizing that their usefulness is over. Indeed, beloved friends, as we come then to the completion of the first of 12 lessons, look well to see that no drops of grace have been ignored. Open the heart ever more deeply. Allow those pearls, those drops of grace, to penetrate ever more deeply, not just as ideas in the thinking mind, but as feelings in the very cells of the body. Let it create for you a sweetness in the flow of breath, a sensitivity in the way your foot rests upon the soil of the earth with each step. Let it begin to transform the way in which you rest your hand upon the shoulder of your brother or sister. Allow that sweetness to permeate your gaze as you look upon another, seeing the Christ within them that is growing into a beautiful flower whose scent and beauty will be as a blessing to many. There is no one among you who is not the evolving Christ. remember always that what you see is what you get, in the same way as what you teach, you learn. So as I read that last segment of that paragraph, there is not one person you ever encounter who is not the evolving Christ. And it reminds me of the story. I think one of the first times I read it was in an Anthony DeMello book. But it's a story about a monastery. And it had been very popular. They had been a center for the town. They'd either had, you know, wildly famous bread making, or maybe one of those monasteries where they made internationally famous fruit cakes or wines. And it had been a bustling, you know, community. People would frequently come and ask to join, and there were limits to how many they could, have living there, so they would be turning people away. But that was years ago. And for whatever reason, the monastery had fallen into, you might say, disrepair. Not that many people wanted to be there anymore. Their products they produced weren't as vibrant. There was a lot of dissatisfaction among the monks. And somehow or another, somebody came to visit and pulled the head of the monastery aside and said, you know, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but one of your monks is the rebirth, is the reincarnation of our Lord. And I know I'm kind of breaking the rules here by telling you that, but, and I can't tell you who, but one of your monks is. And then he leaves. And then, of course, because it's supposed to be a secret, the word gets out. And everybody is secretly wondering if the person they're sitting next to at the table for dinner, or praying next to at their morning devotions, or working next to in the garden, is the Christ. And just that much, just that questioning, just that looking for a sign, was able to turn things around. So even if somebody was testy or snarly or nasty, the monks around that person would think, well, maybe this is a test to see if I can stay loving. Maybe this person who's being angry right now or seeming to be petty, maybe they're really the awakened Christ testing me. And so I'm going to remain loving. And that process evolved to the point where the monastery was transformed, and the energy around the place attracted more people, and that's essentially what we're being led to here in Lesson 12. We're being told not a single person you have ever interacted with was not part of the evolving Christ. What would happen? How would it transform your experience with everyone? Go right back to lesson 3 where it says, look, the first two lessons told you that you're creating your experience of life. And here in lesson 3, we want you to know that every time you have ever judged someone else, each time you dismantle your negative judgments of that person, you take yourself deeper into the purity of your own consciousness when you understand there is nothing in front of you except the energy of creation expressing in form. And you take yourself deeper and deeper into the purity of your own consciousness. You begin to see how profoundly you have been coloring and therefore deeply affecting all of your relationships through the simple act of not being aware of the power of projection. The power of projection happens instantaneously the moment you forget that you're the one creating your experience of life. So if you have a knot in your stomach, a lump in your throat, anger rising in you, if you forget that you're the one creating that in that moment, your mind will instantaneously show you pictures and rationalizations for how the world or people around you are causing that upset. And if you intend to be able to see the world for what it is, if you intend to live into the full liberty that is your birthright, we each of us need to understand we are creating our experience of life. We are creating our impression and our experience of everyone we meet. And imagine how it would change your life if you were able to use the filter, not just the filter that everyone is doing the best they can in each moment with whatever resources they have. That's a wonderful filter. But what if you were able to take it to the next level and understand that everyone you've ever interacted with is the evolving Christ? In the book, The Mirror Theory, one of the phrases that stuck with me the most was, this is whatever you see in a person around you, in your history that you say is garbage history, and the traumas in your life and the mistakes you've made. What if you looked at it and said, here is the love of God in search of self? That transforms your life. I can say that unequivocally because when I read that, I started practicing that, and it's transformed my life. So the next part of Lesson 12 is titled A Meditation of Release. And the text reads, look well then and ask yourself this, who do I know in my existence who I have judged and I've locked into a certain box? And I have decided this is what they are. Who do I know in my existence whom I have judged and I have locked them into a box and I have decided I know exactly what they are. I know who they are. This is it. The text says, there you will find a fruitful meditation for reflection. I would suggest that you use the next 30 days to take time and use it wisely to allow the names, the images, and the faces of those that you have judged to come back to you. And when they do, say the following, quote, you know, mother, father, ex-mate, whoever it is, I get it. I have placed you in a box and thrown away the key. You are stuck, so I have said, and now I release you. I release you from that perception. I dismantle that perception so that I might be released. Close quotes. The text says, contemplate their image. Allow the memories of the experiences you have shared with them to come flooding back. If there are feelings, by all means, let yourself feel them. Deeply feel them. Gaze upon them in your mind until you feel that sweetness that dissolves the imprisonment into which you have placed them. For as that imprisonment begins to melt, you will sense and know that your freedom is blossoming. You cannot take fear into love. You cannot take judgment into forgiveness. You cannot take limitation into unlimitedness. So here's this thing where it says, you cannot take judgment into forgiveness. And as soon as I read that, my mind went back to how many times have have I heard Dr. Michael Rice talk about forgiveness is not pardoning. Pardoning is the process of judging that someone has done something wrong. And according to the laws of the land and these ordinances that men have made, you know, in certain cultures, if you steal something, we get to cut your hand off, and blah, 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 all of this. This is the prescribed punishment that the ordinances of men have laid out for somebody who has been found guilty of doing this thing wrong. Okay, so here it is. We've judged that they've done something wrong. And now we're going to pardon them. But first, in order to pardon them, we have to have made the judgment. Judgment, in this work that we just read, is the opposite of forgiveness. You cannot take judgment into forgiveness. The process of forgiveness in this work is the process of dissolving any perception that I create that results in negativity. You cannot take fear into love. You cannot take judgment into forgiveness. You cannot take limitation into limitedness. These things must be released at the level in which they were first created. Therefore, make note that this practice should not be overlooked. This practice that we just outlined at the head of this section that's titled A Meditation of Release. Think about the people that you've judged. Think about the people where you've said, I have judged you. I've locked you in a box. I think I know exactly who you are. I know that I'm right and you're wrong about this whole panoply of issues. And then say the following release. You know, so-and-so, I get it. I have placed you in a box, and I have thrown away the key. You're stuck, or so I have said, and now I'm going to release you from that judgment. I'm going to go in myself to dismantle my perception, which either led to that judgment or was fueled by that judgment. And I'm going to do that so that I might be released. And then contemplate their image. Allow the memories and experiences that you shared with them to come back. If the feelings come with it, by all means, let yourself feel those feelings. Gaze upon them in your mind until you feel that sweetness that dissolves the imprisonment into which you have placed them. And you will realize that as that imprisonment begins to melt, you will sense and know that your freedom is blossoming. So make that practice something you do. Do not overlook it. This is a caution. Give yourself the next 30 days with the goal to truly go back and, shall we say, mop up any forgiveness or releasing that you need yet to do. Do not let the mind say, well, I don't know if I did that well enough. Understand this. It is the comforter. It is the one mind. It is the Christ mind that releases you and the other through your willingness for this to occur. This is not something you do with your willpower, with your conscious logical mind. So don't let yourself judge it and say, oh, I don't think I did that well enough. Now, there are some effects. This will mean that when you have truly done that, never again do you have any justification or excuse for attaching any experience you have had or any feelings you have ever felt to the hook on the side of their imprisonment that you've placed them in. Often in human mind, the egoic mind, it wants you to hang the coat of its judgment on the hook just outside the bars in which you have locked somebody else in a cage. For instance, well, that which I experienced is the result of my father's alcoholism. Or that which I've experienced in this life is the result of my mother having 40,000 affairs every week. Or that which I've experienced is the result of my business partner who's stolen my golden coins. Or that which I've caused my suffering is the result of the position of the stars in the sky when I chose to incarnate. If only they could have gotten it right, then I would be fine. When you've done this practice sufficiently, you'll never again be able to blame negative experiences you have on someone or something else. The text reads, as we conclude the way of the heart, I say unto you, do not enter the way of transformation until you have truly and fully satisfied your awareness that you are not clinging to even the subtlest iota of perception, that in any way you are a victim of the world you see. So there's a strength to this little paragraph at the bottom of page 146 that says, you know, do not let yourself go into the way of transformation. Do not enter the way of transformation until you have truly and fully satisfied your awareness that you are never a victim of the world you see, so that you're not clinging to even the subtlest iota of perception that in any way you are a victim of the world you see. Don't go into the way of transformation until you truly get it, that nothing has been caused by your relationships, that all of them have merely shown you what you have already decided will be true. The world, then, is not the cause of anything. You merely see what you have used the freedom of your consciousness to concoct about yourself. So there it is, bottom page 146, top of page 147. This is why I went back so many times over this first book, reading and rereading, taking time to do the practices before I ever even began looking at the next book, which is called The Way of Transformation, because it said, don't do that. As we conclude the way of the heart, I say unto you, do not enter the way of transformation. Do not do that until you have truly and fully satisfied your awareness that you're not clinging to even the subtlest iota of perception, that in any way you're a victim of the world you see. Don't move forward until you've erased, dismantled, seen through the falseness of any thought that your upset has been caused by someone outside of you or any relationship you've ever had. Don't move forward until you understand that all of them have merely shown you what you've already decided will be true. Don't move forward until you understand at deeper and deeper levels that the world is not the cause of anything, that you merely see what you have used the freedom of your consciousness to create for yourself. The text goes on and says, for example, lack is not caused by taxation. Taxation is caused by the decision to need to believe that there is a power outside of yourself that needs all of your energy. Government does not cause you to be subservient. Your sense of being subservient, guilt-ridden, weak, and limited is what births the idea of government. And then some of you, as loving brothers and sisters, say, well, somebody's got a rule, so I guess I'll play the part of this politician or that king, or and they become your politicians, and they create the disgruntled feelings that you have. But you're the one creating the situation and your feelings about them. The world is uncaused by anything except the choices you have made as a free consciousness. You have concocted the thought and then immersed yourself in that which reflects back to you what you have already decided to believe. This means that the way of transformation is that way in which one becomes empowered in every moment to become fully responsible for clearly deciding what they will see and what they will not settle, and that they will not settle for anything less. The better you get at this, the quicker it happens, until one reaches the point where miracles occur moment to moment. Yet they're only miraculous to those that do not understand how consciousness works. You can achieve that place in which you hold out the palm of your hand and desire the sweetest tasting apple that has ever been created, and it will literally appear in the palm of your hand. Of course, at that point, you will be well beyond any need whatsoever to even hold the thought of requiring physical form. You will begin then to get a sense of your mastery by being able to look at the world you see and observe clearly what has been changing in it. You will observe how quickly and how effortlessly that which the heart truly desires, because it is in alignment with the mind of the Creator, that whatever that is becomes manifested effortlessly. When the gap between the pure desire and the manifested reflection of it is smaller and smaller and smaller, you will literally sense in the feeling body that mastery is growing. You will know that you are merely a child of creation, playing without ceasing in the sandbox of all possibilities that we call the mind, and that there is literally nothing out there that is solid, nothing out there that is unrelated to you, your essence, your consciousness. So that is where we're going if you wish to come along on the journey. If you're willing to truly become committed to uprooting every root of fear that has taken hold within the depths of the mind that has been rendered unconscious because of your hatred of yourself. It's called the separation from God or the Creator. And therefore, because it has become unconscious, it has ruled you. This is time to release the unrulable by allowing that alone which can uproot the root of fear to come and take up its rightful place within you. What is that? Christ-mindedness. It's time for Christ-mindedness. It's time to uproot every tentacle of fear. You have your homework before you then. Go within yourself and ask, have I taken the time to fully focus on each lesson? And then you may realize, well, wait a minute, when I read that third lesson, I was trying to watch the football game on television. I wonder if I missed something. Or wait a minute, when I read the seventh lesson, I was thinking about going out to dinner. Did I really sit with and extract all of the pearls that were offered there? Perhaps I'll go back and really set aside some quiet time in which I deliberately put the world aside and hang on every word. Yet, do so with a relaxed body, with a soft breath and a non-grasping mind. Be you therefore like a sponge that allows the drops to be absorbed into the self. And that is all. Knowledge, in this sense, is not a cognitive struggle. It's not the arranging of ideas in some order that satisfies the thinking mind. Knowledge, in this sense, is the receiving of a vibration that begins to soften the soil of the heart and dissolve the root of fear from your being. Knowledge is the result of the transformation of the garden that you have been given and entrusted with, which is the field of the mind that is you, the mind that pervades the body. It pervades the space around you, and it melds and dances with other infinite webs of relationship that you call other minds. Energy dancing into energy, unlimited forever, out of which all things of time are birthed and pass away. So you have your homework. Here it is. Go within yourself and ask, have I truly taken time to focus on each lesson? Did I really get every pearl of wisdom? Did I really let the vibrational truth of this enlighten me in each and every lesson? Or was I somewhat distracted? Or did I read a part where my intellect came back and argued against it and shut off the possibility of me truly letting it in? Perhaps I'll go back and really set aside some quiet time in which to deliberately put the world aside and hang on every word, cultivate every word, let its energy resonate through me, see what bubbles up in response to it, let it sink deeper into my consciousness. I think I'll try and remember to do that with a relaxed body and a soft breath and an open, allowing mind. Maybe I'll imagine being a sponge, taking these ideas and resonant energies deeper and deeper into me. Maybe I'll just sit with the concept that in this work, knowledge is not a cognitive struggle. Maybe I'll just contemplate this sentence where it says, knowledge is the receiving of a vibration that begins to soften the soil of the heart and dissolve the root of fear from my being. Maybe I'll go back through these other lessons after having allowed those words and vibrations to sink in a little deeper. So we have not yet reached the end of the 12th lesson, but we have been given some homework. So we've got maybe 5 minutes left for comments or questions or answers or testimonials or any little thing anybody wants to share. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, I'll be happy to turn on your microphone. We have all kinds of hands that just popped up. Is this Susan?
Okay, quick question. You sort of set it up so I don't think any of us is ever going to be able to go on to the next book. I just can't imagine being ready. That's my comment.
Well, remember, it does say, don't let your mind question it too deeply at that conscious logical level. Don't go into judgment of yourself and say, I wonder if I've done this well enough to move on to the next one. You know, do it with this playfulness. Do it with this soft breath. Do it with this allowing mind. And then when you have the thought, oh, I think I've done that enough. I think I'm curious about what lesson 13 might hold. Then go on.
Good. Okay. All right. Take the next call. That was my thought. Thanks for this.
All right.
It's been great.
Blessings. Area code 541, you're in the air.
Miss Celinda.
Hello, Celinda.
I had a similar feeling with Susan, and my immediate response was to allow you to, what is the word I want, to choose what you think or how you think is the best way to proceed to help us really embrace this admonition that was just given to us in Lesson 12. That's about the best I can explain it for you, and still trying to formulate it in my head, because my whole nature has been to rush ahead, and my whole not my whole nature, but my conscious self, and to feel that I must go on and I must gobble up more spiritual teaching, and ending up with spiritual indigestion. But, and I was just wondering how to proceed in that case in relation to listening to the program that you offer every weekday.
Well, I suppose, you know, the simplest thing to say is that there's no danger in reading ahead. They say several times. There's no danger in reading ahead. It's just that if you read ahead and you haven't done the work in the first lesson, you're going to need to go back and reread it anyway. Or after you do the work in these first 12 lessons, then when you read Into the Way of Transformation, you're going to get, you know, infinitely more benefit from it. So it's not like it's danger, warning, don't go here. It's that the best way to do it is slowly and carefully, and having let this stuff sink in, so you get transformed by the practices, so that when other thoughts, energy, vibrations, practices are suggested, they have a completely different alchemical impact on you, transformative impact on you. They won't be like raindrops falling on the desert floor that's been parched and cracked and weathered by drought for, you know, 3 or 4 years, and then the rain just runs off. You'll be that fertile, rooted earth soil that soaks up what's being offered.
Yes, thank you for that. And it's sort of the feeling that, oh, I've got it. I don't need to practice this anymore. I've got it. I'll just go ahead to the next thing. And never really, really, what the word that came up to me when it said receiving of a vibration was the Hebrew meaning, and I suspect the Aramaic as well, of knowledge as actually being a life experience, of actually experiencing it as real in our whole system, not just in our heads, but in our hearts and in our physiology, because of the actions it produces. So that's helpful. And also, one of the things I have really appreciated and want to do, and I've got, I think, the first two chapters done, is to go back and to write out all the sections in a notebook of the indentation, the indented sections of the notebook.
Right. And yeah, I mentioned before that if you do that, that's life transformative all by itself. Just these special quotes and thoughts and filters and perspectives, they're life transforming if you go read those.
Yeah, and so each each chapter has a practice. Well, you do this for 5 minutes a day, and then the next chapter says you do this for 5 minutes a day, and then you run into chapter 10 where it says for 77 days you do this of sitting as Christ, and then now in this chapter it said for 30 days, and so the only thing I could think of was there aren't enough hours in a 24-hour day to do all of that and take care of the mundane things as well. So what I assumed was that whatever resonated to me in the moment, as it said in the earlier chapters, do it then. Don't get bound to it. Don't tie yourself in knots over it. But whatever comes to mind, do that. And then go back, which is what I do a lot in my with my library anyway. I go back and reread something. I underline a lot of it, and I reread it. And, yeah, so maybe it just something to take the pressure off, because the world is a world of pressure, and if I buy into that, and perfection and doing it right and punishment if you do it wrong. And if whenever I buy into that, whenever I hook into that box, it has really bad results for me.
Yep. As it must. Because that's the opposite of what they call forgiveness and the opposite of what they call love and et cetera. All right. Well, you've helped us go all the way to the end. Thank you for that, those thoughts. I will mute you so you can listen in if you'd like to the second hour. Blessings. And the second hour, again, is going to be a replay of a previous. And since I mentioned it in somewhere in this week, at least once or twice, the second hour today and tomorrow will probably be Empowered to Heal, Part 1 and 2. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. This is your second hour.
Tonight in our topic, Empowered to Heal, we want to look at the question, what is health, and what is the cause of health? If you look at the traditional approach in the world, what you'll find is that in order to find health, our billions of dollars are usually spent researching disease. And we're going to look at the idea that that just might be a backward approach, and that maybe health is about something else than an absence of disease. And what is its definition? What is health, really? And the best definition I've been able to come up with for health is not that health is an absence of symptoms or pain, but that rather health is living in our natural condition, living as the being that we are. Now, if you look at the most ancient teachings, tell us that we're made of the stuff called love. And the best definition I've found for health is that health is a state of conscious, active, present love in the human organism. And when we don't have that, we're in a dis-ease state. Disease is not something out there that invades us from the outside and takes us over. Break the word down. It's dis-ease, a lack of ease. And when as human beings, we don't have the condition of love in our minds, in our emotions, and in our physiology, we are literally in a dis-ease state. And that creates a disturbed physiology that leads to what we call organic disease. Now, if you look into most of the schools of healing, they've recognized the thing that they call a second-year syndrome. And the second-year syndrome is what happens in schools of psychology and different schools of healing, where the people studying diseases develop the diseases they're studying. A statistically significant number of specialists die of their specialty. Heart specialists die of heart disease. Cancer specialists die of cancer. Why? Well, in the workshops that we've done in the previous evenings, we've posited the theory that you and I, we are creative beings. If we are creative beings, how is it that we create? Well, science doesn't particularly talk about that, but if you go back to the ancient Aramaic language, in the opening words in the book of John where we're told it says, in the beginning was the Word and the Word became flesh, it doesn't say that in Aramaic. What it says in the ancient Aramaic is that in the beginning was the mind energy and the mind energy became flesh. We were told how it was that we create what happens in our lives. And if we have an intense focus on the vibration, on the energy of disease, what is it that becomes organ eyes? What is it that falls into place in our organic structure? And I'd offer that with an intense focus on disease, we tend to develop diseases. Now, if you look at those who would purvey the things that suppress the symptoms of disease, you'll notice that wherever they're advertised, generally speaking, the first thing that's done is an intense emotional focus on the disease process. Why is that? Does somebody know what they're doing? I mean, think about it. You see the child suffering and the worried parent, and you're drawn into that picture. With what? An intense focus on the disease process, and then pops in the solution. Well, we're going to take a different perspective than that, and we're going to look at how it is that we as human beings create and how we move into the state where we are empowered to heal. That each of us carries with us an energy and a capacity. And that energy and that capacity can make of us disease producers or producers of healing. And it depends how we take charge of our own mind energy system. Again, look at those words. In the beginning was the mind energy. And the mind energy became flesh. Now, if you listen to Einstein, we've quoted this several times, but let's do it again. Einstein says this, on such things as matter, we have been all wrong. Okay? Where does matter fit here? It fits on this side of the equation. On such things as matter, says Einstein, we have been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibrations have become so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. Einstein's telling us matter doesn't exist. And you'd almost think he was reading from the book of John, wouldn't you? In Aramaic. Now, he didn't put the factor of mind in there. But if you look at what organizes, what becomes organized is the mind energy that we engage in. It's our creative capacity. And you look back into the most ancient and the Old Testament teachings, and you hear the Creator saying to human beings, of the works of my hands command ye me. What would we call everything on the right side of this equation? Would we say these are the works of the hands of the Creator? Then what is it that sets things in motion from the left side of the equation? Well, according to that statement, it says, your command is what tells the Creator what to do. Oh, Michael, that's blasphemy. Well, blasphemy or not, hey, I'm just reporting the news. Go read the book. That's what it says. Of the works of my hands, command ye me. The Creator saying, tell me what you want, folks. I'm on the inside. I'm making the whole system work. But I'm going to make the system work according to the way you want it to work. Now, if you want to take the time to study how the system works, you'll figure out that you're the one who's telling me what to do. And if you don't want to take the time to figure out how the system works, then you'll think that you're a victim of something out there, some bug that caused the disease. And there are no bugs that cause diseases. There are no bacteria. There are no viruses that cause diseases. Yes, they are a corollary of disease. They're there when the disease process happens. But that's because the decay of tissue gives rise to a cleanup crew. It is not because the cleanup crew causes the disease process. Now, we have this energy system. When you start to look at, and why is it sometimes a difficult process to arrive at this place of healing, to arrive at this place of understanding, to arrive at the place where we are empowered to heal in every area of our lives? Well, if you look at this human system, what has been organized, if it's true that what has been organized is mind energy, there's a pretty massive accumulation there. In order to show up as this complex a system, it's a pretty massive setup. And when you look at the amount of mind energy that's been put into the system that doesn't belong in the system, and how habituated it is, how habitual it's become to stay focused in the disintegrative mind energy patterns. Now, if you go to the Aramaic language in the Lord's Prayer where it says, "Forgive us our debts," that word debts can be properly translated habits. Get us out of our habit mind. You see, one of the keys to healing is you've got to be out of your mind. That's one of the keys to the process. That you've got to be out of the state where you're stuck in the past. Because the mind energy of the past doesn't leave us available to the present moment. And if we're not available to the present moment, it's difficult to engage in the condition of love that is available continuously for each of us. Now, if you go back again to the ancient teachings, they tell us that we have two different bodies. We have a physical body and a spiritual body. Now, when you look at that, you start to recognize that everything that's in the so-called physical body, or what was called the temple, is an energy that's come from the mind energy of the past. By the fact that it's solidified into form, it is already in the system. And this so-called physical, its name was Adam. Adamos means red clay. So we have this system that's made of red clay, and the red clay stores memory. And then what it has stored as memory, when it makes a reappearance in our minds pretend, or so it would seem, that what's coming from our past is actually the present. And if we as creative beings get locked in that past and keep producing it over and over and over again, then we'll be stuck in that syndrome of, why is this happening to me again? Now, when I say everything from the human mind, from the Adam mind, and you'll remember the ancient teachings talked about the fact that we have two minds, that we have the ability to be in Adam's mind, or be what was called being a son of Adam, or we have the ability to be in the Creator's mind. You'll remember Paul said the goal of the work was to be of like mind with Christ. In other words, to engage another mind. If we continuously engage the mind of the past, then we're going to keep reproducing in our creative process the past. And you've got to start to deal with present time, bypassing what's gone in the past, if you're actually going to heal what's in your system from the past. Now, that may seem like, gee, Michael, I've always been taught to experience life through my mind. How else can you do it? Well, that's one of the problems. That's what we've always been taught. And one of the keys is to be able to step back from your mind and observe it in operation. To kind of become the thinker apart from the thought, the feeler apart from your own feelings. So I'm going to invite you for a moment to do that, if you would. I'm going to ask you to step back from your mind for a moment. And as you do, just watch what happens in your mind. Observe it and catch it at its game. How about, if you would, putting your right hand on your right ear? Would everybody do that? Put your right hand on your right ear? Now, you'll notice if you look around the room that everybody's doing pretty much the same thing. All right, put your hands down. Now, why did everybody do the same thing? Well, obviously, Michael, you told us to. I've got a different theory. I don't think that's why you did what you just did. I think that you, like I, had a mother who taught you, this is a hand, this is an ear. And when I spoke those words, I resonated a reality from your past, stored in your Adam mind. And when I resonated that reality, it came forward and gave you a set of instructions, and you followed those instructions. Let's imagine, for example's sake, that Jerry has a different past than everybody else in the room. Let's imagine that Jerry's mother taught him this is an ear instead of this. When I said put your right hand on your right ear, what did Jerry do? Did he do this like everybody else? No, he did this. Why did he do something different? I mean, we're all in the same room at the same time. I gave the same instructions to everybody. Why did he do one thing and you do another? Because the instructions that came from his mind, from his past, resonated by my words in the present, were different from the instructions that came from your mind in your past. So did you actually follow my instructions? Or did you follow the instructions that were in your Adam mind that came from your past? Two totally different behaviors based upon what was in the past. Now, it can be difficult to catch the mind at its game at first, at its trap. And so building a time delay in can help to make it easier to catch the mind at its game. So I'm going to ask you once again to step back from your mind and observe it in operation. And as you step back and observe it in operation, this time instead of putting your right hand on your right ear, would everyone please put your right hand on your gizzard? Would everybody do that? Put your right hand on your gizzard? Now, notice what just happened in your mind. And unless I miss my guess, it probably went something like this. Gizzards. Let's see. Chickens have a gizzard, and they're up here. Or are they down here? And do I have one, or just chickens? Kind of how it went? Notice you went searching through your past to find a reality for the present. Now, if in every experience of your life, you have to look through your past to find a reality for the present, where do you live? You live in the past. Those who lived in the past were said to be the dead, who were buried by the dead. If we don't know how to step out of our past, if we don't know how to step out of Adam's mind and bypass what has already gone before us, we cannot be open to fresh creation. And as creative beings, that's what our capacity is, to engage in original creation. And when we engage in original creation, we must, of necessity, engage in it out of our created being, which is love. Now, there's a big argument going on the planet, creation versus evolution. And that's a really important argument if you think you're a body. Because, of course, whether your body came from apes or not might be important. But when you realize that you are not a body, it's an irrelevant discussion. There is a created essence called a soul in Aramaic, nafsha. And then there's a physiological component, or what was called the Adam body. If you go back and you read the creation story, and I want to really make it clear that when I approach this whole process from the Aramaic, I'm not looking to delve into religious principles. I'm looking to the Aramaic, which is a physics language, the Aramaic, which is the native language not only of Jesus, but of five of the world's major religions. There's a reason for that. And I think the reason is because each of those religions started out of a physics language that knew how the world worked. And then usually men took over and made it how men wanted it to work and used it to control others. But in the original essence, there was a story about, here's how life works, folks. So let's look at the creation story. You'll notice in Genesis, the Western creation story, there are two stories about the creating of human beings. You ever looked at that? The first one says, in the image and likeness of God he created them, male and female he created them. Period. End of story. The human being is created. Now, I've heard some preachers stretch a long way to make sense of this because just a couple of lines later it says, there was no man to till the soil. And they start another creation story. It's like, was Moses getting senile here or what? No, I don't think so. I think that it was known exactly what was being said. There was no man to till the soil was saying there was no physiological component. There had not yet been the solidification that we call matter. The creation of the human being had occurred. We are created essence love, a spirit being made in the image and likeness of a spirit being called God, a spirit being called love. If you go forward to John, it says that the Creator, God, is love. And we're made in the image and likeness of that. So here is our essence created of love. Now, I've asked this question of you before, and I'll ask it again, because it's such an important question. How many can remember coming into a world and looking around at the world of strife and conflict and fight and negativity, and looking through small eyes that said, that's not the way the world's supposed to work. It's supposed to be different than that. How many remember knowing? Most everybody remembers. And because we're doing this on camera, I won't go to the audience, but every time I ask this question, the same reply comes. It's some variation on the theme of love. Why? Because you and I are made of the stuff called love. We come into this life knowing what we're made of, knowing what we're here to express, and then the world goes about tearing us out of it, and we tend to buy in. So let's look at the second creation story, the soul. Love is created. And then the second aspect says there was no man to till the soil, no physiological component. And then it goes about developing the evolution story. And then Adam is now present. And then the final statement marries the two. Adam is created. And the final statement there says what? And God breathed into Adamos nafsha. So the created spiritual essence love is now breathed into this evolved physiological system. God breathed nafsha into Adamos, and nafsha became a living or an incarnated being. Now, imagine this physiological system that's evolved through this strife-filled world, through this conflict world, and it has lots of protect mechanism and knows all about survival. Survival is its game. And imagine this soul being breathed in and saying, hi, I'm your new landlord. And Adam saying, Adamos saying, well, what are you talking about? What do you mean? Well, the Creator breathed me in here and said, I'm in charge now. You see, you're just a set of programs. You run on a pre-programmed survival mechanism. And now I've got choice. I've got something new in the creation. Something showing up now that's never been before. And you'll notice if you look through all of the creation, you don't find one creature that goes against what it's programmed or structured to do. Now, you won't find two robins in the spring that come back to Omaha and land in your backyard, look at each other and say, isn't it great to be back in this beautiful backyard? But dear, you know, we've been coming here for 5 years and every year we build a robin's nest. I think this year we should build an Oriole model. You won't find a robin doing that. The robin can't do elsewise but to build a robin's nest. You won't find a salmon in the South Pacific swimming along in those nice warm waters that all of a sudden gets the call and says, say what? You want me to do what? Let me get this clear. You want me to leave these nice warm South Pacific waters? You want me to swim 3,000 miles back to that icy cold stream that I was spawned in? You want me to swim upstream, get half beat to death on the rocks, lay eggs and die? You're crazy. I'm not going. You won't find a salmon that does that. The salmon gets the call. It finds the very pool in which it was spawned and does exactly what it's structured for. And so it is with abdominals, the physiology. It was an interesting piece of research that was done by a psychologist and several years ago. And actually, I don't know whether the research is as interesting as the fact that he got something like $9 million from the government to do this research, if I remember the numbers correctly, and I may be off there, but a significant sum of money. And he wanted to research a thing called a sand flea. And what they had observed with these sand fleas, okay, a sand flea is a creature that digs a hole in the sand, and the interesting thing about it is that whenever it wants to eat, the sand flea goes and finds food, brings it back, sits it at the edge of its hole, goes back in the hole and does whatever sand fleas do when they do that. It comes back out, gets the food, and eats. Well, the psychologist decided that when the sand flea went back inside of its hole to do whatever it does, he'd remove the food. And so he did. And the sand flea comes out, and there's no food there. So it goes off, and it gets more food. And it comes back, sets it at the edge of its hole, goes inside, does whatever they do. The researcher took the food. The sand flea came back out, the food was gone. The sand flea goes and gets more food, comes back, sets it at the edge of its hole, goes inside. The researcher removed the food. The sand flea comes back out, you get the story? You know how long the sand flea went and did that routine? Until it starved to death. It doesn't. This physiological system doesn't have the capacity to change its own mind. Adam can't change. Can't change itself. You know, there are countries in which monkey meat in the past has been a delicacy. And the way they would trap monkeys is they'd take a coconut, they'd cut a small hole in the coconut, just big enough for a monkey to squeeze its hand in. They'd empty out the coconut meat, they'd put food in it that would attract the monkey, and attach it to a tree. The monkey would come along, be attracted to the food, stick its hand inside, get a handful of food, and now it can't get its hand out. And it's trapped. And it isn't bright enough to let go. The monkey body, monkey mind, the atom mind, can't let go. It can just run whatever's in it over and over and over and over again. And so look at this creation story and see that our abdominal system has a memory bank filled with everything from its past. And it's programmed for survival. It knows how to survive. So let's imagine the objection that this Adam mind puts up to Noxia in saying, look, what do you know about life? What do you know about survival? I know how to keep us alive. Before I turn this system over to you, just because you've got choice, so what? Before I turn it over to you, I'm going to give you a test. There are two berry bushes over there. If we eat the berries off of one of those bushes, it will kill us. If we eat the berries off the other one, it'll nourish us. Do you know which berries to eat? What do you mean, kill us? What are you talking about, says Nafsha. Doesn't know anything about death. And the ego mind, or Adam mind, explains death. Oh, gee, I didn't know anything about that. Well, I'll tell you what, maybe when it comes to choosing food, you better take care of it, because I don't know. Well, let me give you another test. There's a huge Tyrannosaurus Rex down the road there. If we get upwind from it, and it gets a whiff of us, do you know how to escape? Escape? Why would I want to escape? What do you mean? Well, hey, we're in big trouble. If he catches up with us, we're dead. Oh, gee, I don't have a clue. I don't know. Oh, so you really don't know much about survival, do you? Well, I guess I don't know. Well, then maybe you shouldn't be in charge of this system. Maybe you're right. Tell you what, how about if we're in a survival situation, you run the show, Adam, and when we're not, my choice, I'll run the show. And so you can almost imagine this negotiated settlement. Now, how does this relate to you and I? Well, let's look at how it works in our lives. A situation that I think all of you will probably be able to identify with. Let's imagine that, and I'm going to assume, seeing as how you're watching this tape and you're at this workshop, that at some point in your life you decided that life was about love, that you wanted to go back to that original created condition and express life that way. And you'll notice that, especially in your closest relationships, you were fully able to do that, right? until that person you're in relationship with gave you the look. And what happened to your choice? How do they determine what's a survival situation? Well, we could easily imagine that this negotiation that took place between Nafsha and Adam resulted in, well, let's invent an emotional meter. And the meter goes from 1 to 10. Anything above a 7 is survival. As long as the meter's below 7, you've got choice. It's up to you. Do whatever you want. But if something comes along that resonates that emotional meter and it goes beyond 7, choice is over and you're going right back to the old programs. You're going to run life just the way your past has structured you to run life. And if hate and fear and intimidation and gossip and slander and vengeance have been what's in your past, your monkey body, your monkey mind can't let go. It doesn't know how to change itself. But you, Nafsha, when you wake up, remember the creation story? One of the first things that happens to Adam after the creation, it says, he fell into a deep sleep. You notice there's nowhere that it mentions him waking up? Why? Is it because most of us as created spiritual being, as love, have fallen asleep in that reality structure that comes from our Adam bodies? And that whatever seeming decisions it makes, and its decisions are just repeated programs, they just run. In any circumstance that looks like a past circumstance, the program runs. Whether it's appropriate or not. Gee, I want to create love and support and nurturing my relationship, but if somebody gives me the look, well, gee, when I was 3 years old, that meant this 280-pound Hulk was going to come down and beat me with the belt. So now here I am, 40 years later, in a relationship with someone I love dearly, and they turn their head just the right way to resonate that old reality. What happens? Choice is gone. This is survival. And though now I'm dealing with the person that I love and not a 280-pound Hulk with a belt in his hand, what do I do? If I haven't forgiven, if I haven't removed that energy from my past, I'm going to play it out. And after I play it out, I'm going to say, oh God, why did I do that? That's not what I wanted to do. That's not my choice. Anybody ever done that? Done anything against your own will and choice? Do you see why it happens? It's because when the emotion meter hits 7, you don't have choice. You're going to run on automatic pilot. But where your choice lies in the healing process, and each of the tools, people will say to me oftentimes, well, Michael, how do I heal this situation? How do I heal this? How do I heal that? All of the above. That's all we ever talk about. Every tool we teach in this work is about how you remove the realities from the mind that don't belong there so that this emotional meter doesn't hit 7. And you don't fall into survival where there's no survival issue involved. And so to wake up to who we really are and to take charge of this system and make real choices and remove from it that which does not belong in it is one of the keys to being empowered to heal. It's one of the ways that we wake up to who we are. So health, I would offer, is a state where we embody in our minds conscious, active, present love continuously. And when there is something less than love, we remove it. We take it out of the system. And we step back into who we really are as created spiritual essence, as love. And when we're able to presence love in our minds, whatever of those old realities that come forward that no longer serve us, those survival realities, by the simple exposure to love, by the capacity to hold love, conscious, active, and present, when one of those old emotional meter issues comes forward, it literally creates a transmutation of energy. Which tomorrow, if we face the same circumstance that today locked us into an old behavior we'd rather not do, by having exposed that old behavior to love, it changes. It diffuses the energy. It's called the process of forgiveness. Forgiveness in the ancient Aramaic language means a tool for changing a reality in your mind. So if there is a reaction, you know, break that word down, react. How did you react to that situation? In other words, how did you do an act that you'd been taught to do on a previous occasion? And that's all the atom mind's capable of, but as spiritual beings, we're capable of more than that. We are actors. And we are capable of engaging in original creation, of bringing into every circumstance in our lives the being that we are, the love that we are. And the ancient Aramaic is, for me, has been the closest that I've been able to find to describing that process and what it's about. And once you start to study the framework and the culture of the Aramaic in its true original form, and you will find things from the Aramaic that even those things are not on target when it comes to the teachings of Jesus. Why? Well, go back and you hear Jesus saying, even to the people of the day in Aramaic, you know, there are many things I would like to say to you, but you can't hear them yet. We've got to be able to deepen our experience to match the experience that was being talked about in that language to be able to comprehend it. Elsewise, a higher teaching has to be reduced in its level of understanding to the level that the person interpreting the teaching has reached. You can't be at a level 7 and understand a teaching at level 10. It just doesn't happen. And so to deepen your own process, to take charge of your own energy system and deepen the experience of being love, as you look at that teaching in Aramaic, you'll come more and more to comprehend what it spoke of in real human terms. And it loses its religious significance, and it takes on, for me, something much greater. It takes on the significance of life process. It wasn't about some intellectual process or ceremony called religion. It was about, here's how life works, folks. The Aramaic language was spoken for right from the Middle East to the Great Wall of China for 1,000 years before the birth of the man named Jesus and 1,000 years afterward. It was the languages of each and every one of the Old Testament prophets. It was the language of Baha'u'llah. It was the language of Zoroaster. It was the language of the Old Testament scholars. 5 of the world's major religions. Why did they stay around? Because of their level of understanding. Why is it that we want to go back to that language and that culture to gather an understanding? Well, let's use an example. Let's imagine that we go to the jungles of South America and we follow a fellow who has done a 5-day trek and he's 20 miles from his home. He's farther from his home than he's ever been. And he lives a jungle existence within his culture. He has never been out of those huge jungles in South America, and he's never experienced anything like modern civilization. And let's imagine being 20 miles from home, all of a sudden he hears this roaring noise, and he goes to the edge of the jungle to inspect, and he sees this huge yellow animal with round legs running back and forth in the jungle, just knocking down trees left, right, and center. And then he watches another huge animal come along and lay down this black surface over everything where the trees have been knocked down. And I mean, over a period of days and weeks, he just watches from the edge of the jungle in amazement as this happens. And then all of a sudden, one day, he hears this roaring noise in the sky. And he looks up and he sees this huge bird, bigger than any bird he ever could have imagined. And imagine this bird lands, and it's an unusual bird in that it opens its mouth, which is on the side instead of the front, like every other bird he's ever seen, and it spits out live people. I mean, this is some kind of bird, eh? And then it eats more people and takes off again with a roar. Now, of course, you and I know what he's just observed, don't we? But let's imagine now that our friend, having observed an airplane, goes back 20 miles in the jungle to explain to the rest of the tribe what he's just seen. Can he speak one true word about what he's observed? I mean, let's think about it. He saw this huge bird that was shiny like the sun. It had no feathers. Its skin was as hard as rocks. Its eyes were huge. Its mouth was on the... Can he say anything true about what he's observed? Not possible, is it? What is he going to have to do to enable him to speak to those 20 miles deep in the jungle about what he's experienced with an airplane? Well, he's going to have to come into and build the brain cells for what an airplane is and what modern transportation is. In the ancient Aramaic, that was called having the eyes to see and the ears to hear. So he's going to have to develop the eyes to see and the ears to hear what that's about. So let's imagine that he stays with these people. They meet him, they befriend him, they teach him the language, and now he understands about international travel. Can he go back into the jungle and explain to his friends 20 miles deep in the jungle what he's experienced? Can he say one true word about what he's experienced? No. They don't have, they've never been out of the jungle. International travel, what are you talking about? Airplane? Well, what are they going to have to do? They're going to have to build the brain cells. They're going to have the eyes to see and the ears to hear what's being spoken of. And so the first step is that they're going to have to develop the brain cells. Remember Jesus said his teachings were only for those who had the eyes to see and the ears to hear? Now there are things that you can say in the Aramaic language and culture that you cannot say in the westernized versions of those scriptures, because most of the westernized versions come from Greek. I've actually had preachers. I remember one man who had been a fundamental preacher for a little better than a half a century. And when I started to talk to him about the Aramaic, he literally, and I quote, said to me, "I don't care what Jesus said." I was just aghast. I couldn't believe what I heard. And his explanation was, "I studied the Greek and I know all about the Greek text. And that's enough for me." Well, that would be like our jungle friend going back into the jungle knowing nothing about the language of international travel and explaining to his friends what he just experienced and trying to make a logical sense of it. You ever looked at a lot of the scriptures and it's like, how does this make sense? Where is this coming from? Well, that's why. Because there are things you can't say in Greek that are said in Aramaic. Why? Well, if you look at the whole Greek, and let's look at the difference in the philosophy and the understanding of the Western mind that produces an airplane and international travel, and the jungle inhabitant who hasn't been outside of the jungle or a 20-mile radius. There are no words, there are no concepts that can be communicated effectively between those two worlds until the brain cells are built to make sense of it. Well, in precisely the same fashion, if you can see the dichotomy there, let's look at the ancient Aramaic, where you have a man named Jesus who says things like, "The Father within me does the work. It is the Father's good pleasure to bring you the kingdom. And if you ask, you will receive." Now, let's just take that part of it. And then let's see if you can say those things in a Greek conceptual framework that knows nothing of internalized God, but rather has this whole external pantheon. These creatures that kill their mothers, rape their daughters, do all sorts of horrid things. They're called gods in that Greek philosophy, right? In the Greek mythology. And the powers are all externalized. Now Jesus talks about a process of forgiveness, which is a way that you reach into your own mind to remove the realities from your mind that are your disease And then you go to the Greek language, which has externalized all the powers, and instead of forgiving, you start pardoning. Instead of a power within, it becomes some horrified power out there that's out to get us. Look at the whole base of understanding, and now look at the Western mind and how many are still looking for some God out there that's going to get them, and some afterlife out there, and the name of a man who in Aramaic said, hey, if somebody tells you the kingdom of God's over there, over there, over, don't believe him, it's within you. You can't make sense of it in Greek. It's not until you go back to that Aramaic structure that the whole energy system starts to make sense. For me, when I first contacted the Aramaic, it was so exciting to me because my background was in electronics and physics. And what I immediately saw was, this is a physics language. This language describes how life works. This language describes how this physiological system works. Ah, mind energy organizes this world of flesh. This makes sense. And all of a sudden, when you go to that framework, the whole thing starts to fall into place. And it is built to liberate people. You go back and listen to Jesus, and he says, know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Now let's look at what is generally referred to in our culture as the beloved King James Version of the Bible. You know, if you went back and talked to the Founding Fathers would not touch that book. Because it was government issue, it came from the king. The previous versions of the Bible did not support the divine right of kings. James said, I want the divine right of kings in there. And he went about having a translation done. Now, let's look at the structure in England at the time when James had that book written. The way the culture was organized was sort of on a pyramid level. You know, pyramid schemes in our culture are illegal, right? Why? Because it turns over everything from the bottom levels to those at the top, and the people in the bottom end up losers. So you look at that structure, and you had a group of people who were literally chattels. They were owned by the property owners. The whole base of the pyramid in that culture were people who, if the overlord sold his lands, everybody breathing, by the way? If the overlord sold his land, the people went with it. They were owned. They were property. Now, you don't have to look very deeply to see, you know, you just look at the word that was used to describe them. What were they called? Peons, right? And what happened? They produced on the land, they worked the land, they sometimes were able to keep enough to eat, and they turned over the results of their produce to the next layer, to the overlords, to those above them, who of course were fewer in number, but they basically owned the property and owned the people that worked the property. And of course, that next layer, that next level, had to turn over what they produced, a certain percentage. They got enough to keep them alive, a little more than the peons. And they went to the next level. And it went up to the next level. And who sat at the top? The king. Now, how many are naive enough to believe that this guy wants to accurately represent the teachings of a man who said, know the truth and the truth will set you free? Not very likely. And so when we start to go back into the actual original teachings of Jesus in his native Aramaic, in his native tongue, we'll start to see that he was about liberating people and teaching them of their creatorship. And that what he was teaching them was how to remove the dis-ease processes that they had engaged in. He taught them how to forgive every reality that was not in their minds. And so healing is not about fixing a broken part of the system. If we put into this system an energy, look at this thing as an energy system, and we put into it an energy that does not belong in it, wherever we store that energy, we set up a dis-ease process. The process of healing is not the process of suppressing the symptoms that reflect in the organized state, in the organic structure, but rather the process of healing results from removing what does not belong in this system. Removing the overlays that we've put in it that block its original intelligence, its original capability, and its natural state of health. So if we're ready to look at the problem, we get to see what's really going on. Now I'd like to move from the ancient physics language of Aramaic into some modern writing, and I'm going to read some work from a man named Fred Alan Wolf. Fred Alan Wolf is a physicist. He's a former professor of physics at the University of Paris and at San Diego State. And here's what he says. He says, the only mystery, let's look at the world from and look at physiology now from a physicist's point of view. The only mystery of quantum physics lies in the wave-particle duality described by Richard Feynman, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. He says that atomic objects, electrons, protons, neutrons, etc., sometimes behave like particles and at other times behave like waves. In other words, what do we have? We have a state where this thing we call matter is spread out over space as a wave, or it collapses and becomes a particle. So he says, atomic objects, electrons, protons, neutrons, etc., sometimes behave like particles and at other times like waves. When does an atomic object behave like a particle and when like a wave? According to many quantum physicists, the answer depends on whether or not the object is observed. Key, what is observation? The action of simple observation causes the wave to collapse, producing a particle. Nobel laureates Eugene Wigner, Brian Josephson, and many other physicists believe that this action of consciousness is a fundamental event beyond physics. Fred Alan Wolf goes on to say, we view it as the action of consciousness. Without such actions, the world and all of its participants would remain wispy, ghost-like quantum waves, and there would be nothing physical at all. Now, what is this thing we call the observer? Well, when you recognize we live in an energy universe, let's do something here with color that'll kind of demonstrate what we're talking about. Let's imagine that we have a blue potential. Let's imagine that we have a wave that is a red potential. We have a green potential. We have a purple potential. Now, let's imagine that each of these are potentials for solidifying or collapsing and becoming the world of matter. But something has to interact. Something has to add an energy to any one of these for it to collapse and become a particle. So let's imagine now that we have an observer whose mind energy, let's let this blue represent a world of fear. Let's let red represent a world of anger. Let's let green represent a world of healing. And let's let purple represent a world of love and awakened spirituality. If we have a person whose mind energy has been filled with this frequency, brain cells have been filled to the max with fear and intimidation, And you'll recall the last few nights I've talked about the work I did several years ago with Marcel Vogel, who was a 23-year senior scientist from IBM. Marcel developed the instrumentation in the lab with which to measure the high energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. So when we put the realities of fear into a mind, we set there an energy. All energy is in motion, and all motion produces an energy wave. So if that's the frequency, if that's the wave that this person, and if you could trap the whole world of people into those brain cells of fear, out of the quantum potential, which wave is going to be in resonance, which through resonance is going to have energy added to it and is going to collapse? We're going to see this collapse out of the quantum soup or the quantum potential and become the world of matter. Now, once it has collapsed, imagine you're the observer looking at all these fearful people out here. Do you suppose it's going to do any good to work on trying to get them to change? It's not going to happen. You're going to have to go back to where it started. Remember Job in the Old Testament said, "That which I feared most has come upon me." What was he saying? He was saying, "Oh, I see, I'm a creator. When I engaged in fear, I set up an energy wave. I set up a frequency. And here it is, come to visit. Now, instead of trying to get rid of the visitor, I think I should probably go back and forgive." Which means what? I'm going to literally restructure the brain cells. What are we going to restructure them with? Well, if I forgive, and remember that forgiveness means a tool you apply to a reality in your mind to remove that reality, which is a tool that you apply to an energy in your physiology, which if it is fear, is a disease energy, and whatever tissue it's in, it violates the integrity of that tissue. So you remove that, you forgive that, and all of a sudden, this wave is no longer the predominant resonant energy in your mind. What's going to tend to happen? This wave that has collapsed will tend to go back to the world of potential, and its solidified nature will disappear. Now, let's say that having dealt with the fear, oftentimes the next stage is to get really peeved about what they've done to us, to get really angry. So if the next predominant resonant energy is red, if that's what shows up, having forgiven the anger, all of a sudden now I'm really peeved at what's been going on all this time. This is an energy. This energy sets up a field. What now starts to become manifest in the potential world? You know, they spoke in the Aramaic of illusion. And usually in our culture, we're taught that illusion means something that doesn't exist. In the Aramaic, the root of the word illusion is not something that doesn't exist. The root of the word illusion is measured. Remember they said, as you measure, it will be measured unto you? As you put an energy into your mind, guess who's coming to dinner? Guess what's going to show up? You set up a frequency, and out of the quantum soup, out of the potential, what you have measured solidifies, collapses, and becomes your experience. Is anger ever going to get you where you want to go if you want to live a delightful life? If you want to heal, it's not going to happen. Now, you might have plenty of reasons to be angry. You might have plenty of reasons to be horribly abusive to them. But that's really not the essential question. If you want to heal, the essential question is, though they deserve it, do you? Because you get the original, they just get the carbon copy. And if they're not in resonance, they're not going to play. If you really want to heal, you have to take charge. And you go back and you listen to Jesus, and he said, you know, the first order of business, the first law of life, of aliveness, of joy, of creativity, of really high-level wellness, is you've got to hold the condition of love in your mind. And when you do that, you'll start to dismantle that energy, that information in brain cells that resonates and sets up lots of things to be angry about. And as you change that frequency from your mind, that potential, or pardon me, that which is solidified, will tend to go back to the world of potential and dissipate. And the next step is you'll start and you'll begin to engage in the healing process. And when that becomes the predominant resonant energy in your mind, you'll set up. And what you'll find is you'll create a world and you will start to attract people and circumstances that will support your healing.